order to get that last little bit of sensitivity, you make sure that it's very close to the right tuning before you go to higher amounts of power. If you started off with high power, you can be doing arc welding inside, as you know. High Q cavities can do that. They build up ridiculously high voltages if they're not being properly loaded at that frequency with the output device properly tuned down range and so on. So you've got to be asking a few more questions. You definitely want to have a sit down with Andy, among other people, before you proceed with this. Please come back periodically and let us know how the project goes, Steve. And are you thinking of, on a final there, Steve, are you thinking of putting a repeater at your location, KC2MDB, K2RIW in the TechNet?
WW, a couple more, a question, Dick.
Go ahead, Howie, pick it up.
Just curiosity, do you know what kind of repeater you're going to be using and how much power? And this is a UHF repeater, I assume. Do you know what type of a repeater you're going to build it out of? Is it going to be made out of a Micor or something?
Yes, it's a Motorola desk track, and it puts out 40 watts.
It puts out 40 watts. You know what? All right. You're probably going to want a gas set in front of it. And I think you could probably, in the used market today, find a PD526 or a TXRX duplexer. I'm not a big fan of TXRX duplexers because they're harder to tune. You need a special tool. I like the PD526, but DB Products and Sinclair makes it. You want a six-cavity duplexer, and you want one extra cavity on the receiver. That means you want a six-cavity duplexer, you want one extra cavity on the duplexer. I can tell you from experience, I've tried mobile duplexers, and I've tuned them up all kinds of crazy ways when I didn't have the access or in the pre-days of having service monitors, and when you were a kid growing up, you didn't have a lot of money, you had to do all kinds of weird things. And I built repeaters out of TR-22s, and I played with progress lines. I can tell you this much. From experience, you got to get frustrated. Look at getting a PD-526, or look at getting a Sinclair or a DB product. And if Dick wants to turn it over to Joe can make some more comments. Joe has a lot of experience in building repeaters. Over to you, Dick. K2RIW, WD2HWW.
Without a doubt, as I see it, Steve, you can take the Cadillac approach, buy the best brand name of duplexing filter of the right model number, and as far as the hardware goes, the problem goes away. As far as tuning is concerned, you still got it. However, when you take a guy like Mel, K2KEY, who has completely home-brewed from scratch, from start to finish, the whole duplexing filter and got good performance, I know you can add the extra cavities, homebrew if need be, to the hardware you've got and pull it all together. You're going to have to ask the right questions. It's going to take a little bit of research, but I wouldn't give up. I mean, if you've got a whole lot of money, you just want to go out and buy it, go right ahead. And maybe the MDP I know has got it's got money burning a hole.
E2EJ.
Got all kinds of...
You can get on the used market a duplexer for around $300. They're not that expensive anymore. You can buy them at flea markets for about $300.
Okay, so you can either buy it or you build it. And in either case, you're going to have to ask a few more questions about the proper tuning procedure. But I wouldn't give up, Steve. I think you can add the missing hardware without a whole lot of money if you so decide. Let's see. At this time, we're supposed to switch over to Mel's mailbag. And so what kind of burning questions have we got, Mel? After those questions that Mel has received this week, we'll have a quick report, if there is one, from Paul, WS2N. And then we still have WB2CUK with a question, which will be beyond all that. Because we promised everyone in the first hour we'll give them at least a brief answer. K2KEY, what kind of burning questions this week, Mel? K2RIW in the... You got it, Mel.
Okay, there's the seat. This is K2KEY. Yeah, had kind of a busy week, and I got another one coming up this week, so I may leave you guys a little earlier tonight. Got an early appointment tomorrow. And let's see. I'm looking through here. Something, you know, that we can answer for. Some of them are very complicated. I don't think appropriate. I still get a few of those, even though they've papered off. Okay, here's one. I bought a secondhand oscilloscope at one of the ham fests. It's a 5-inch scope, has all vacuum tubes in it, and I noticed something. It works well. However, why does the frequency range control on this say range 1, 15 cycles. I'm putting in the word hertz. 15 cycles to 150 cycles. 150 cycles, number 2, 150 cycles to 1,500 cycles, and so on and so forth. Whereas I noticed the new oscilloscopes have MS, microseconds, and all that. Why have they changed this? What is the difference? Go ahead, Dick.
Yeah, I've got some guesses on this one. It sounds like the oscilloscope was intended for testing of audio circuits, and the main thing you care about is taking the audio waveform and synchronizing things in such a way so that either one cycle or two cycles or maybe three cycles of the original sine wave are on the screen and sitting still, so to have the right sweep rate so that that frequency of audio signal can be synchronized and sit still on the screen is the main requirement of that kind of a oscilloscope, because the shape of the sine wave on the screen tells you whether or not the final stage of your audio output amplifier is giving you crossover distortion, where you've got a little bit of a glitch as it goes through zero, or flat topping distortion because it's being overdriven, doesn't have the right power supply. So looking at the purity of the sine wave of one or two cycles on screen was the main thrust or requirement of that kind of early days audio spectrum analyzer. Let me drop.
Recurrent squeeze sweep scope thing.
So I guess that's what the name that was given to it, John. Maybe I'll have John give me a few more words on that. Modern day oscilloscopes are used in a much more quantitative manner. We now want to know the time domain rather accurately, so that the main knob on the spectrum analyzer that has many clicks to it is set up for numbers like 1 millisecond per centimeter, 100 microseconds, 30 microseconds, 1 microsecond, and so on per centimeter. So now you measure the exact timing of events, usually digital events, but not necessarily, or power supply trip times and things like this. So in the modern day use of spectrum analyzers, event A is how many microseconds or milliseconds downrange from event B is the kind of thing we tend to measure. And the exact waveform we measure a little bit less frequently. You probably know a little bit more about some of these older oscilloscopes, John, so give us a couple of words on what you were just telling us. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, they were called recurrent sweep. They didn't really have trigger functions. They synced on the waveform itself. And they did have a range between a certain amount of cycles per second, and you had an adjustable sweep range that you could pull it through. And they were terrible. But they worked well. Like I said, low frequency, they did work well. And you could learn a lot with that.
Even though the oscilloscope is made, from what we're hearing, it's made primarily for audio testing, if it's got enough gain and it's got an AC coupling network, or you could add one to the outside, it still would allow you to measure the amount of ripple on a regulated power supply. It'll allow you to measure events like a closing of relays and so on. So oscilloscopes are always a lot of fun. And the fact that it's got all tubes inside is not necessarily bad. That makes them very inexpensive to buy. Yeah, modern-day oscilloscopes, except for the cathode ray tube, are almost all solid-state, and even the more modern oscilloscopes, even the cathode ray tube is made a solid-state liquid crystal or whatever substitution. So what we all tend to do is start off with a particular oscilloscope, and as we get our feet wet and we get a little more knowledge and we get a little more money, we start trading up to better and better oscilloscopes. The oscilloscope that I finally traded up to has got four separate channels and goes to 250 megacycles per channel. And it suits my needs very nicely, but I didn't need all that in the beginning. What was your first oscilloscope like, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. This is a 5 megahertz scope that this gentleman is talking about, and was used, it was a general purpose oscilloscope that was somewhat popular back, I guess we'll go back to the 50s or early 60s. So the dial, I didn't read them all off, but it says here the top range of it was somewhere in the neighborhood of 100, went up to 150 kilocycles. Of course, as John mentioned, that it was based on the old multivibrators and all kinds of basic vertical input amplifier, horizontal input amplifier. It did have a sync range and all. So it was basically a general purpose telescope. In fact, they were used mostly for TV service at the time, over.
I might throw in a couple of words here as to what is an oscilloscope, just for somebody who's never heard of it. It's a cathode ray tube where the vertical display is the voltage that you're applying. The horizontal display is usually a sawtooth waveform, a repetitive waveform, and hopefully there's a synchronizing circuit that'll make the signal sit still on screen. If you just change the horizontal sweep rate while looking at the vertical deflected signal you're applying to the front panel, most likely the signal will continuously crawl across the screen, and you'd like to make it sit still. And there's a circuit on many oscilloscopes called synchronization that makes it sit still. When you synchronize it, what you're really doing, the oscilloscope is a kind of a stroboscope. In reality, that sine wave that you're looking at, whether it's coming from an audio oscillator, a tuning fork, or you're looking at the signal in the IF strip or whatever, the signal has got, if it's 100 kilohertz signal, there's 100,000 sine waves per second continuously swishing by the point where you put the scope probe, and you want to look at one of them, so to speak. Well, you can lay a whole lot of them on top of each other, and that's what a stroboscope does. So by having the horizontal sweep work at the right rate, you're painting the exact same waveform as far as what your eye sees on top of the screen, but you could be pointing, if it's a 100 kilohertz sine wave signal, you could be painting that single sine wave onto the screen 100,000 times per second.
K-E-2-E-J.
When things are properly set, you're painting that on the screen that many times. So it really is a stroboscope, and you're making things sit still. Go ahead, Eric. K-E-2-E-J, K-2-R-I-W.
An additional comment, too.
Dick, I just wanted to make one comment. All untriggered oscilloscopes of the early days, like your ICO, were always, the sweeps were always variable speed, and it was listed in frequency, so that's where it came from.
Alrighty. So in other words, the modern day oscilloscopes, when you use the click positions, where it is calibrated for 1 millisecond per centimeter, 10 milliseconds per centimeter, 100 microseconds per centimeter, and so on, most of them have a second knob in the center, a little round knob, that you unclick it, and it now allows you to change the sweep speed in a continuous manner between those extremes. So we still have the same function we used to have in the old days. In the old days, that sweep circuit was really a potentiometer which operated continuously, and you slowly operated it in order to make the signal sit still on screen as opposed to crawling. And you could do that even if the synchronization circuit wasn't working correctly. Berkeley. KC2WGB, KQRIW.
Exactly, Dick, and that was the free run mode, and you can still do it even on the modern Tektronix today. But a question for Mel, I'm sure he's done it. Years ago, we used to build oscilloscopes out of the old discarded television sets. I'm sure he remembers that.
I wonder if you've ever done that, Mel.
Well, I built a number of, scopes and all. I used to pick up surplus tubes, of course, CRTs were a dime a dozen. Especially when I got into flow scan, the T7 phosphor CRTs in the 3-inch and a 5-inch sizes were literally, you buy them for under a dollar or whatever, brand new. Portland Street was literally packed with them. Then there was also a lot of these scope tubes, in fact, there's a question, another question here, that there was some through that at the same hamvention, his friend picked up some kind of a oscilloscope also, and he wants to know why this oscilloscope that he picked up at some kind of a military unit has a pin, an actual pin in the middle of the CRT, Dick, over.
In the case of the PPI, Planned Position Indicator, for a radar system, some of the early ones had a pin in the center, and the display would start from the center and sweep outward, and it would start at 12 o'clock. It would start at the center and sweep up to 12 o'clock, and a few seconds later, it would start at the center and sweep to 1 o'clock, and the where the oscilloscope swept to represented where the radar antenna was pointing at that instant of time. The radar antenna is on a rotary joint, and it's sweeping 360 degrees, maybe once every 12 seconds, and therefore any echoes you got back from that radar we could point painted onto that oscilloscope screen as a Z modulation, they called it, an intensity, and therefore if there was a target out at the 3 o'clock position, which maybe is due east, and the target is halfway in range, the way the radar was set, you would have an intensified dot halfway between the center and the outer edge in the 3 o'clock direction, representing that particular target at that particular position, at that particular range. I wonder if that's what you're talking about, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Oh, yes, I remember those pieces of equipment from World War II quite well. That pin in the center, I think, had a dial on it, if I'm not mistaken, a plastic sort of see-through piece of plastic that had graduations on it. I think you aligned that correctly with the direction of the ship and used that, and then the offset from that would direct the fire of, the firepower of the ship. The CRT had that pin right through the center of the screen. Boy, oh boy, that's going back. In fact, I believe the radar of that time was basically, I think, on around 2 meters, Dick, over.
Without a doubt, there were some radar, the early radars were on the VHF frequencies. And the radar that was on top of a mountain near Pearl Harbor saw all of those aircraft from the Japanese invasion of Pearl Harbor, saw them on the screen. Those particular personnel hadn't been properly instructed what to do when they saw something like that. The radar installation was so new that the people hadn't been properly trained. As I remember, 7 o'clock in the morning came around. Their shift was over. They turned the equipment off, even though there's a whole lot of signals on screen, and they thought that was a friendly aircraft doing some kind of an exercise. They turned off the equipment and went to sleep, so to speak, and a few minutes later, those aircraft on screen arrived at Pearl Harbor, and all hell broke loose. So, my goodness, did we learn a lot of lessons on that one. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Roger. Unfortunately, that's what took place, and of course, later on, with the radar coming aboard ships, by 1942 or 3, famous Battle of Midway, took place, and the United States Navy was able to annihilate the Japanese fleet at the time at night, because the Japanese did not have any kind of radar at all aboard any of their vessels. So they were completely helpless at night, because everything, their gun directing, they directed their guns only during the daytime by the old method of using two type of telescopes and, you know, cross-referencing 2 points. So at night it was useless. So the radar basically was able to, no problem to see at night, and annihilated their fleet. So I guess that's part of the way it evolved, Dick, over.
And it's part of why I could call it the Wizard's War, or the war of fancy instrumentation, which really made the difference between life and death. Do you want to go through one more of yours, or do you think you've had enough for tonight, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, I just thumbed through them. You had asked me about my first oscilloscope, which happened to be a thing called a Sencor. Sencor did produce a little oscilloscope, a 3-inch oscilloscope made of all surplus parts. Back, I guess it was back in the late 50s, early 60s or so. And was $29.95, the scope. And with that little oscilloscope, I became the so-called expert at doing a lot of so-called tough dogs on television sets locally for a shop. Because with that little oscilloscope made specifically for servicing the early days of television sets, the black and white, you could actually test video circuits, you know, vertical, horizontal, you know, but what was nice about it, it had a output from the multi-vibrator, and you could ring a yoke or a flyback transformer or any of the vertical output transformers and things like that, and then look at the waveform and tell whether it's good or bad. So that it made me sort of, like I said, a magician over.
Yeah, the early television sets with cathode ray tube, the majority of them had a magnetically deflected yoke circuit around the base of the tube right after the gun assembly. And so the horizontal deflection magnetic coil and the vertical deflection magnetic coil, the first thing you would do is make sure that it wasn't an open circuit, and your ohm meter can confirm that. But the much more difficult thing to analyze was whether or not there was one shorted turn of the multi-turn coil around that ferrite magnetic structure. And one shorted turn would take the inductance of that horizontal coil, say, for instance, which maybe was, I'm picking a numbers out of the air now, maybe it was 15 millihenry, and it would bring it down to microhenries real fast because of one single shorted turn. And so by putting a impulse or a sawtooth waveform into it and look at the way it it rings back. I mean, if you were, for instance, testing the primary winding of a power transformer for a television set, and you got the transformer thoroughly disconnected for everything, it's sitting on the table, and you take the two primary leads and you put it across your triplet or Simpson volt-ohm milliammeter in the times 1 ohms scale, and you held those wires onto the two scope probes with your fingers. You watched the needle slowly come over as the primary of that transformer got charged. You would watch it slowly come over to maybe 1 or 2 ohms of the primary winding. Then you would disconnect it. Oh boy. You would you'd disconnect one of the scope probes by loosening your fingers. And the stored magnetic energy of that transformer would come flying back out as an inductive kickback. It probably made a very brief 500-volt pulse out of its primary. Your fingers are still touching those wires. You felt that brief 500 pulse, and out came some strong, salty language out of your mouth, and you wondered,
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
And you'd wonder, what in the world is going on here? However, if that power transformer had one single shorted turn in the primary, or one single shorted turn in the secondary, and you measured the number of ohms in the primary, or the number of ohms of the secondary. You would come up with exactly the right number of ohms. But because of the shorter term, which would not allow a large rate of change of magnetic field, therefore the inductive kickback couldn't take place because of the shorter term. So you would know right away if a transformer was defective, because as you disconnected your triplet, that little blue spark you would see of inductive kickback did not take place. Or if your fingers are crossed it, you wouldn't get the shock across your fingers. So there's a similar phenomenon going on, testing whether or not you've got a shorter turn in that deflection yoke of a old-fashioned television set. But you've done things like that in your day, haven't you, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, never was wrong with saying whether a flyback or a yoke was bad, because that was known as the coil ringing method. And you would see a difference when you put that signal into the coil, which is coupled from the scope. Connect the probes appropriately. Like, for instance, if you were checking a flyback, you put one the ground on one end of the flyback coil. You connect the vertical input to the other, and you should see it was called a damper curve. Basically, a damper waveform. If it looked like just almost like a distorted or almost like nothing, you know right away you had a shorter turn in the flyback, which of course you can never determine with a meter. You can determine it like, you say, an open situation, but you know, you can never determine that one short possible turn or something is effective into the flyback coil itself that was, of course, encapsulated. So that's what I did, Dick. Over.
I'm going to give you guys a couple more words about the very crafty circuit that existed in a large percentage of the television sets between 1948 and 1975, probably, and maybe even beyond, maybe even 1985. In the early days, it was a 25-watt capable pentode tube which created horizontal deflection. So a sawtooth waveform was fed into the control grid of that tube. The plate current went into the primary of a transformer, which got called the flyback transformer. You'll soon see why. The secondary winding of that transformer went to this deflection yoke, which was a chunk of ferrite magnetic material with a coil of winding built into it, a fancy-shaped coil of winding. That was wrapped around the neck of the cathode ray tube. So as the sawtooth waveform went through that vacuum tube, went through that so-called flyback transformer, and the secondary winding went to this coil of a yoke around the cathode ray tube, a magnetic field was created which swept the dot across the screen horizontally, and that gave you the horizontal deflection. The horizontal deflection is taking place by way of a sawtooth waveform. The end of the sawtooth waveform at maximum voltage, which was maximum current in that coil, would suddenly jump down to zero to start the next cycle. But the way magnetic circuits behave, when you suddenly go from maximum current to zero current onto the circuit, a magnetic circuit will not, a inductor will not allow you to instantaneously change the current. And here you're trying to do that. So as you try to go to a zero current, you get a great big inverse voltage flying back out. That coming back out of the yoke, coming through that transformer, went through a very fancy rectifying tube, the 1B3 tube, which was good for 30,000 volts or something like that. The
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
The flyback magnetic collapsing energy, inverse voltage, as it was called, rectified by that tube, gave you the 25,000 volts that eventually went to the front of the screen of the cathode ray tube, and that accelerated the electrons from the gun to the front. So the high voltage was coming from the horizontal deflection circuit. The horizontal deflection circuit with the rapidly collapsing magnetic field at the end of the horizontal sweep is what did all that. So if your horizontal oscillator circuit or horizontal deflection tube failed, you not only had no high voltage, so therefore the screen was dark, the signal that would, the sawtooth signal that would normally go to the horizontal portion of the yoke was no longer there. It was a combined circuit. And you go one step further. There was a particular television set I had once where the audio output amplifier was simultaneously the voltage regulator that gave you the right voltage to operate the tuner assembly in the front end. The tuner needed something like 100 volts to work correctly, and that was coming off the cathode of the audio output too. So by normal troubleshooting procedures, you knew you had a bad tuner because it couldn't tune to the various channels, and you thought something's wrong with the tuner, and you took the set out of the cabinet and you brought it back to the shop, and who in the world would ever believe that the audio output tube was the reason why the tuner wasn't working? So some of these very crafty circuits could sometimes throw you for quite a loop when it comes to troubleshooting. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, that definitely was wonderful. I'll say one thing, it was great practice. It really, believe it or not, a lot of people will say to me, you know, in my engineering, where'd you get all your experience? And I will say that working with TV sets, fooling around with old TV sets, always trying to do all kinds of crazy things with them, provided me with a good basic knowledge of working circuits and troubleshooting. I should say troubleshooting techniques, how to go about troubleshooting techniques, because I can tell you a few times I heard stories when I was teaching them, you know, just bringing up hypothetically how you would troubleshoot a circuit. And I heard things, Dick, some of them, that I had to control myself from laughing because, yes, if you took it from the book, it sounded feasible, but was impractical in general use, Dick. So I will say one thing, the TV service as a youngster and also helped finance my way through school and all, I have to thank you for all that. Did give me a heck of a head start in this business. Over.
As you can tell, Mel and I had found each other as kindred spirits. We were both born the same year, almost the same month. We both worked our way through school by fixing television sets. That's where the cash came from to pay for the tuition. And an awful lot of our electronic knowledge came from developing troubleshooting procedures, signal tracing and power supply tracing procedures within television sets is where we learned an awful lot of the electronics that we use. Let's see if Paul is available, WS2N. Do we have a space report tonight, Paul? WS2N, if you're there, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, Dick, WS2N, let me recycle here.
Hey, you sound good.
Okay, we got a few things, Dick, to report. Expedition 28 is going up to the International Space Station, and that'll be this Tuesday. And they're going to launch from Baikonur. They launch from Russia. They go up on a Soyuz craft. And that's what they're going to be doing for quite a few years. So you have an American on board, a Russian on board. Russian is the commander and a Japanese astronaut as well. So three people going up. And they call it Expedition 28. Every time you have a launch from Russia or a new crew on the space station, they give them expedition numbers, and this is what we're up to. So it's amazing. 10 years, and you've got all these different crews there. Three people for each expedition. Let me drop it. So I just wanted to mention that. You do have the Atlantis will be the final mission going up for the space shuttle, and that'll be going up supposedly July 8th if everything goes well. Of course, you know, with the technical problems and weather delays, who knows, that could be delayed, but hopefully that goes up on time. 12-day mission. You only have 4 people on board. But that'll be it. From here on in, we'll have to rely on the Russians and eventually SpaceX, private corporations, to bring people to the International Space Station. Deep space missions will be reserved for NASA. That is now on the table. I brought that up last week. They're going to be doing that, developing the what's left of the Orion spacecraft. They're going to re-engineer that, and that will be the new spacecraft carrying up to 4 people into possible deep space missions. But that, now, look at that. I mean, they only have a spacecraft, a heavy launch vehicle to launch that craft. So it might take quite a few years before that happens. So we'll rely on Russians and private corporations for now for manned missions. This is WS2N. Let me drop it. One thing I wanted to bring up, I think it was John, KC2WGB. He was the last week or the week before he asked about a spacecraft that was going to test the salt in the water, how much salt is in the ocean, well, all the oceans. But I did look that up, and now NASA actually has it on their site, and it's actually called SACD, SAC-D, built by the Argentina Space Agency, you know, with help from, you know, a couple of other sources. You know, on board, they have a NASA instrument, the main instrument on board the SAC-D spacecraft. Now, SAC-D, by the way, I can't pronounce. You know, it's written in foreign language, so what that stands for, I don't know. But the instrument on board is called the Aquarius. That's probably what John heard about. It was the detector is a NASA instrument put on this thing. And it's going to be launched from Vandenberg Air Force Base in California, not Florida, on a Delta II rocket. Let me drop it. And it's a 400-mile high orbit, roughly, and it's going to be what they call sun synchronous orbit, so kind of like a polar orbit. And it will be a 3-year mission, and they'll test the salt. How they do that is with this microwave. They have they call it a microwave radiometer. It's a nothing but a big old microwave, like the frequency of a microwave oven. It's around 2.4 gig, and it'll be transmitting down to the ocean. Whatever it sees coming back, it could tell the temperature, and salt water, well, when you measure it in Kelvin, it's cooler than regular water. So they could tell the temperature coming back of this reading. We drop it on how much salt is in the ocean, and they'll be able to map the whole Earth in 7 days. Every 7 days, they'll be able to do all the oceans, and with that, they'll be able to tell. You know, it's some kind of future prediction of how things are going with global warming and all. So it's very hard to get the statistics, to test all the oceans, you know, with the boats and planes and whatever. And this one, you know, satellite that's going around the Earth for 3 years is going to do it, so they'll have a good idea of what's going on, for the scientists anyway. How it's exactly, you know, how they figure that out, I don't know. You know, that's one of the things. One of the measurements that they need is how salty is the water. So I'm glad John brought that up. I looked it up. It's called the Aquarius instrument aboard the SAC-D, S-A-C in parentheses, -D satellite built by Argentina, being launched at Vandenberg by Delta II rocket. So I thought I'd mention that, and that's pretty much it. Opportunity, by the way, is got about 18 miles on the odometer. It's about four or five times more than Spirit has. And it's still doing good. Back to you, Dick. WS2S.
Have there been no failures at all, per se, on Opportunity? In other words, all of its wheels are turning. Its rock abrasion tool is working. All of its cameras are working. Are there essentially no failures? They're getting fairly full power output from the solar cells and so on. And is there reason to believe it's going to go on for a few more years? What do you think, Bill? Go ahead. I'm sorry, but the Paul. You got a Paul.
Okay, as far as I know, there's no failures on that thing. Still doing well. And that was the one that was, you know, that really aced it. That was the one that landed right in that Endeavour crater. It was a, they call it a hole-in-one, you know. They looked out right away on day one, and they could see these big crops, rock stem, you know, rock coming out of the side of this crater. And to do that, remarkable. Scientists love that. It's on one crater after the other ever since. So they have to go on these long, long journeys like Spirit did to find something. Spirit went to the hills, they call them the Columbia Hills, and went up first spacecraft really to climb a mountain on another planet. Did that successfully. But Opportunity didn't have to do that. It would go from crater to crater and rock to rock. As far as I know, there's no failures. In fact, I just looked at the website today, and it's doing well, and it'll go, and, you know, for years to come, they'll keep putting operators on it, Dick. They'll never give up.
Can you imagine maintaining a human being on Mars, giving him food, water, oxygen, continuously, essentially 24 hours a day, every day, for the last X number of years? Can you imagine the resources required as opposed to that remotely controlled device? So that's one of the examples where unmanned vehicles give you an awful lot of bang for the money. And Mars is a very hostile place with very little atmosphere, very cold temperatures. And so I'm not so sure you want to put a man there, even though it sounds exciting. I'll see if Bill is still with us. WB2CUK. He signed in with a question earlier. WB2CUK, go right ahead, Bill. K2LIW in the TechNet. Yeah, I was a little bit afraid that Bill wasn't going to be able to stick for as long as we had to, and we're trying to stick to this particular schedule. Now's the time when we go into the deeper subjects, and I'm going to go over to John first, because I think John did say I bet you John said he had an earlier question that I should have gotten to. So we'll give you a double dose, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Dick, can you also put me on before we start?
Okay. You're on right now, Mel. K2KEY, go right ahead.
And KC2, Mike Yankee, too.
The headlines this week with the cell phone commentary about people with getting these tumors, brain tumors, and all, and they're blaming it on prolonged use of cell phones. I wonder where you stand on this, because we sure heard quite a number of news reports this week about it. Over.
We sure did. I guess I ought to give a little bit of a talk on that as to where I stand. Let me type this in. Good. A good buddy of mine, Mike Knox, who was my supervisor for a couple of years, back in 2005 or so, he not only just got an award from Brooklyn Poly, where he teaches on J Street in Brooklyn, Brooklyn Polytechnic Institute is what I keep knowing it as. I know they've given it a new name, SUNY New York at Brooklyn Poly or whatever. Anyhow, he's one of their best electrical engineering professors. He previously was the main application engineer for the Hewlett-Packard company, which became the Agilent company, when it comes to their exotic instruments like spectrum analyzers and vector network analyzers. Let me drop. Okay, very recently the World Health Organization, WHO, took a whole bunch of other reports, tried to sum them all up, tried to come to a compendium with them, with the subject of cell phones. Do cell phones create health hazards and brain cancers and whatever? And so there's no real definitive information that says absolutely it does. There's an awful lot of information that weakly says, no, there's absolutely nothing to worry about. But to try to prove a negative is extremely difficult. So to be, for political reasons, the WHO, somebody held them at gunpoint saying, you've got to make a pronouncement after 20 years of use of cell phones. Are they safe or are they not? You guys are the World Health Organization. You've got to have an opinion on this. And their opinion is that they gave it a class 2 Bravo, which means that it might be a weak carcinogen. Well, that started a whole flurry of activity. All of a sudden, all of your major networks went to whatever they thought they could get to as an expert in a microsecond, as I call it. They would grab a hold of a neurosurgeon or somebody else and say, okay, do you see a whole lot of brain tumors now that we're all using cell phones? And the real epidemiological study does not support it. The best article I know of that you can see is, as I said, April 17th issue, 2011. New York Times, Sunday edition, the colored section. There's a beautiful 6 or 7 page article called Do Cell Phones Create Brain Cancer? Very nicely written article. And by the time you plow through all of it, you'll come to the conclusion that there's no way you can be sure. The rates, if they're there, are much too small. Let me drop. There's approximately 6 brain tumors total per 100,000 in the general population of the United States. 6 brain tumors per year per 100,000 people. Just to give you a calibration of what that means, if one or two of those brain tumors are due to a cell phone, and all the others are due to all the other things that we're exposed to, everything from nature and nurture, in other words, your genetics and the carcinogenic pesticides and the fertilizers and the high fructose corn syrup and the artificial sweeteners and tremendous numbers of pharmaceuticals. There's all kinds of things. I could easily list, if I wanted to, I think, I could list 150 things that a modern day human being is exposed to that may or may not be the triggering agent that could give you with your particular genetics the possibility of a brain cancer. And if you're also a cell phone user, you could easily come up with anecdotal evidence and you say, aha, that's it. And there's a lot of people coming up with anecdotal evidence. And you've heard me say so many times, the people in Bayville, Long Island, a nice community on the North Shore in Nassau County, part of Oyster Bay Township, the Bayville Village people are trying to eliminate all antennas from their town of any kind, cell phone, fire, police, ambulance. They want all those antennas put in somebody else's town. It's a nice goal, and because the water tower with all those antennas, which is a high place in the town, is right across from the school, a student in the school got leukemia, a teacher in the school got cancer, and so from that anecdotal evidence, the 7,000 residents of that town said, aha, those antennas are it, we got to take them away. And the fact that there were multiple wells in Bayville Village that had to be closed down because they contained chemical contaminants, no one considers that. Okay, so ABC Television last Wednesday or Thursday, I guess it was, called up Brooklyn Poly saying, you've got to send us an expert. We want to make a measurement. We've got a volunteer family who has something like 7 cell phones in the family. 3 of them are being used by the children. One of them is a toddler who owns a cell phone that doesn't get turned on, but they're using lots of cell phones. Can you come and make measurements? So Mike Knox was chosen by Brooklyn Poly as a man to go there. He had about an hour's worth of notice to get on a train, get on the subway, grab his spectrum analyzer, go there and make a measurement. They, ABC Television, supplied the radiation hazard meter, which whether or not it was calibrated is not known. So Mike made a bunch of measurements. He measured the computer, the cell phones, and whatever, on his spectrum analyzer and on his on the radiation hazard meter that they provided. And this, by the way, was on Nightline Television last Thursday night. The actual measurement took place about 6 o'clock or 5 o'clock in the afternoon. They had enough time to edit it and put it on Nightline at about 11 o'clock. At about 11:50 is when it went on. And it was about a 10-minute series, and Mike Knox was on camera probably 3 or 4 of those minutes making those measurements. And so everything looked very safe until they got to that particular microwave oven. And now I'm a little worried, because the way a microwave oven works, the door seal does a beautiful job of keeping out all of the radiation. The a in-specification microwave oven has less than 1 milliwatt per square centimeter, measured 3 centimeters from any one of the edges of the door or any other place you can on the microwave oven. Let me drop. And because of the way the RF choke works, the microwave choke works around the edge of the door, in order for the microwave oven to fail that specification, you've got to do one of about 3 things. You've either got to have a tremendous amount of food splattered on the outer seal of the door so the door can't close correctly, or you have to have a broken hinge on the door so that it doesn't hold the door correctly against the rest of the body of the unit, or you have to have some loose screws where the magnetron is screwed down to the microwave oven itself. These are the only things I know of that can create a failure. And so among the microwave ovens that we're using, thousands of them in the United States, I think you'd have a lot of trouble finding one per thousand that fails that specification. I've made measurements on the microwave ovens that I own, and the signals coming out of it are so weak they're very difficult to detect and way far away from the standards. Well, this particular microwave oven in this particular home was failing the spec. Was their health being harmed by it? The amount by which they failed it, in order to get in trouble, you would have had to hold your eye at the edge of the door, hold your eye open for 6 solid minutes while something in the microwave oven was being cooked for 6 solid minutes, and then you would be at the threshold of alarm where you might get a cataract if you did all of that. The way a person normally uses a microwave oven, where you're not holding your eye that close, and it's not that, and you're not holding your eye open, not holding your eye that close, not running it for 6 minutes, with almost nothing in the microwave oven, which makes the signal coming out a lot stronger. When Mike first got there, everyone wanted to test the microwave oven by just turning it on. And thank goodness Mike was smart enough to say, you've got to put at least a cup of water in there. The instruction manual on every microwave oven tells you that you're likely to damage the thing if you put nothing in it. Because now all the microwave energy is bouncing back and forth, it all comes back to the tube, and now all of that seven...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
All of that 700 watts that's supposed to go into your food, if your food isn't there, the 700 watts all reflects back to the microwave magnetron tube, and now the tube has to dissipate an extra 750 watts. And there's a high probability if you do that with nothing in the microwave oven, you're going to damage it. So apparently, before Mike had gotten there, somebody had been testing it that way, which was really not way to do it, not the right way to do it. So I hope Mike gets a chance to go back and find out what really was going on there with that particular microwave oven. But apparently, that was the one appliance in this house, which was not the one that everyone suspected, which was at the threshold of alarm. Is it really at a dangerous threshold? I doubt it, but at the threshold of alarm, without a doubt. So Mike Knox made a pretty conservative set of statements as to what we measured and what we should be worried about, some further investigation of that oven should take place. Well, a more compact edited version of that speech of Mike, so to speak, appeared on the news reports the next morning, and because of the way it was edited, it made it sound like Mike was clanging the bell of alarm that, hey, bad things are happening here. And that's not what he intended to say at all. So, right now, a hell of a lot of people think that cell phones are dangerous. I'm almost positive they're not. Whenever you see any of these computer-generated graphics that somebody comes up with, where they model a human head, maybe a child's head, with a cell phone against the head and the cell phone running at full power, and they show with a red coloring of the massive materials within the head, you know, where the heating is taking place. And most of those studies are inaccurate because they're all based on the assumption that the antenna built into the cell phone is located right at the ear. In the old days, it was. It was a little whip antenna very close to the ear. Now I would guess that 99% of all the self-respecting...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
99% of all the self-respecting cell phones you can buy these days, the radiating antenna is located down at the bottom of the cell phone, close to where the microphone is located. And there's a bunch of reasons they did that. Number one, if the antenna is right at the ear, you fail the HAC requirement. HAC really means hearing aid specifications. When enough RF energy goes into a hearing aid that's in somebody's ear, that RF energy can give some funny buzzing noises and whatever into the hearing aid. So they don't put the antenna there. Second of all, when they put the antenna down by the microphone, the SAR rating goes down, the specific absorption rate. In order for a cell phone to have good communication capability, it must radiate a certain amount of signal, radio signal. You can cut down that signal if you want to, and the SAR ratings get real good, but now your cell phone's going to have very poor range. There's no way that the cell phone, within its extremely small size, has the capability, within the laws of physics, of creating any significant amount of directivity of its antenna pattern. The antenna pattern out of almost every cell phone is almost a pure isotropic with a couple of dimples in it. In other words, if you see it as a so-called Satomo plot, Satomo is the name of a French company that makes a three-dimensional plotting machine that measures the signals that comes out of things that you're testing, and I call it the apple plot. Usually the high radiation areas are red and the lower radiation areas go to blue and black. And you look at the plot coming out of almost any cell phone, it looks like an apple. It's a great big round red object, so to speak, with a little bit of a dimple in one or two spots where the stem of the apple would be, and that's the direction in which, for some reason, the cell phone doesn't radiate quite as much signal. So the cell phone is essentially an isotropic signal radiator. So if it's going to have enough signal coming out in enough directions, let me drop... enough signal in enough directions in order to be able to communicate with your particular cell site that you're near at the time, it's going to go in all directions, and the human being's in one of those directions. So if it's got enough radiated signal to have any reasonable range, it's going to have a significant SAR rating. And the SAR rating that we're allowed to have in the United States is 1.6 watts per kilogram, averaged over any one centigram, any one gram of material, of protoplasm. So 1.6 watts probably creates an amount of heating, if it was near your head, that's equivalent to 1 or 2 tenths of a degree Fahrenheit. The exact number I don't know. But now you have to ask yourself, since radio energy, after 60 years of research, has only a thermal effect, for 60 years we've been looking for the non-thermal effect, no one's found it. So it creates heating, just like the way it cooks your food. When you radiate a whole lot of power, 750 watts into your food, you get heating of the food. We call that cooking. When you radiate a fraction of a watt with a cell phone, you get a tenth of a degree Fahrenheit, maybe, of heating of the nearby material of your body. And is that significant? Well, you get a lot more heating than that, because 1,000 watts gets put into your body when you lie in the sun in the summertime when you're at the beach. The actual amount of signal you get from a cell phone base station, if you are very small distance from it, would be equivalent to the amount of energy coming out of a 30-watt light bulb. So if you think that a cell site is a dangerous thing, then you would also think that a 30-watt light bulb is dangerous, because they're both creating approximately the same amount of heating if you're at the same distance from them. So if I'm 5 feet from a 30-watt light bulb, the amount of heating my body gets is almost identical to if you were 5 feet from a cell phone base station running full power. Many of the towns are coming up with these 500-foot rules.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Hempstead was the first one that I've heard of doing it, and then I'm very unhappy to find that Huntington Town decided to copy Hempstead. And so a cell site base station is no longer allowed to be placed within 500 feet of a school, a place of worship, or a home, which essentially outlaws everything in the town or the village and all those places. 500 feet. Where did that number come from? It's somebody's pure rabbit hat trick number. The right number is 5 feet, and even that would have a safety factor to it. So, as I see it, because World Health Organization was forced to make a pronouncement